This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm going to read something about tonight, and then I'm going to introduce the speakers. And it's really something very different for us. And I think it's hopefully going to get you enthused about the brain and thinking about creativity in general and where the brain sits in the middle of all that. So this is the first course for the Mini Medical School on the multidimensional mind. It is presented in association with Bay Area Science Festival that is presented by Chevron. This 10-day celebration of science and technology is organized by UCSF Science and Health Education Partnership. It occurs annually across the Bay Area. There is a website that you can all read more about this. We thank Gladstone Institute, which is a world-class science institute to which the Nobel Prize was given this last year to Shinya Yamanaka. It's an amazing place. Thanks to Shannon Noonan from the Gladstone, who's helped us with this organization. Okay, so I'm going to start by talking a little bit about visual creativity and brain circuitry. I'm a behavioral neurologist, and because I have incredible patients, I've been forced to think about not only the bad things that happen with neurologic diseases, but also to think more broadly about my patients and begun to realize that some amazing things have emerged in the setting of degenerative diseases. The next speaker will be Keith Vossel. Keith comes from Tennessee. He tells me he plays classical guitar. He's a fabulous neuroscientist. Keith trained in neurology, did a chief residency at Harvard, came out here to do a fellowship in our program, and has worked on model systems, understanding how Alzheimer's disease develops, and he's thinking very carefully about treatments that I think are much more clever than any of the ones we've ever had before. And Keith's task tonight is to think about creativity in the science laboratory. So I can't wait to hear what he's going to say. I have no idea. Our next two speakers are just amazing. And when you talk about Renaissance women, they are epitomize it. Let me start with Indre Vascana. So Indre, it was the lowest point in her life, but she worked for me for a brief while. And she came out of UCLA neuropsychology PhD program, where she got award for the most extraordinary memory thesis in the entire world that year. And she studied what happened in single neurons in the brain when somebody sees someone who's familiar. And she has worked in science, but also is, as you'll hear, an amazing singer. And she has started Opera on Tap in this community, which allows you to have a beer, listen to opera, talk while it's going on. It's a very novel Indre-style kind of invention. So Heidi Clare, also unbelievably talented, master's in music education, probably the world's best classical fiddler. She was the visiting artist here at the Memory and Aging Center, where she really transformed our program. And Heidi is just an amazing educator. She has one of the most exciting bluegrass bands in the world called At a Gollop. And she is going to interact with Indre both here and across at the Sandler, in our building to really get you excited about music and the brain and emotion. And I think nobody does it better than Heidi. So thanks to Leslie Goss from my team, Eleanor O'Brien, Carolyn Latham for putting all this together. Okay, so one of the things that I thought about, my mother's an artist, and really I appreciate art enormously, although I have, like music, zero capability. Because I appreciate art so much, I've wondered where does art come from in the brain? And I think this is a modern picture from a man named Marcel Mesalem, who thinks about how complicated our cortex is. We have probably 100 billion neurons. These neurons make us who we are. And what he's shown here in pink are some new areas in the brain. In the frontal lobe, you see here, also in the parietal lobe. And these are areas that are almost certainly important for the generation of creativity. But visual creativity is, got its own circuitry. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight and emphasize the difference between what the left hemisphere does and the right hemisphere does in association with the production of a painting. So I think here's the theme, here's the conventional wisdom, and this comes out of a lot of lesion literature where people have had strokes or brain tumors that affected one side of the brain or the other. And the theme has been that the right brain, particularly the posterior parietal lobe and posterior temporal lobe, is not quiet. It's quiet, but it's dominant for artistic ability. And so no doubt, people who are visual artists have more activity, more cells, more going on in that right posterior part of the brain than the rest of us ordinary people. The left side of the brain contributes to art, but it's been a little more ephemeral to understand what it does. And it seems to be involved with some of the symbolic linguistic aspects of language and also of painting. And I'll give you a couple examples of the sort of thing that I think the left hemisphere might contribute to a visual product. And it's certainly, there are conceptual artists probably here, even here tonight. And that is, I think, a very left hemisphere activity. But I'll explain that a little bit with a picture or two. So one of my heroes, and I've never met her, is a woman named Betty Edwards. And I think her book, written decades ago, is incredibly modern, and she wrote a book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. And she's an art educator, and she spends time with people who want to learn how to paint. She thought a lot about handwriting. And I think one of the tools that she has used in her class is she thinks that she got people to turn off the left side of the brain, the symbolic, conceptual, word-based area that we're specialized for on the left. And to do that, she shows a picture of Teddy Roosevelt to begin her class upside down. And if any of you have ever done this exercise, it really works. So look at Teddy. If you're not a good drawer, and I'm first in line for that, if you try to draw Teddy Roosevelt right side up and you're not good, you don't do a very good job. When you look at the picture upside down, the product is much more impressive. Betty Edwards sort of intuitively believed, and I think now we're starting to get evidence that that's true, that what she was getting her people to do in her art class was turn off a little bit the firing in the left side of the brain, that is thinking logically about how to draw Teddy Roosevelt, and getting a more visual approach to it, more of a gestalt by turning a Teddy Roosevelt upside down. And I think now we're learning from neuroscience that what Betty Edwards had proposed is really actually happening. So I'm going to say a little word about what happens when you injure the right posterior part of the brain. And this is about Fellini, the great filmmaker. And, he was very visual, obviously. He made really great films. And, what many of you probably didn't realize is he was a cartoonist. And he made these gorgeous, very humorous, funny, interesting cartoons. And didn't take, more than a few strokes of his brush to give you a very interesting caricature of people. Here's a self-portrait that he did before he had his stroke. And I think you, get the humor and, so much of the richness of Fellini's mind. That's one of the amazing things about art is it's, the one visual process that you can actually get a feel for what's going on in somebody's consciousness as they roll out a piece like this. So Fellini had a stroke in exactly the wrong place if you want to produce art, I think. And that was the right posterior parietal lobe. And so with his neurologist, he sort of documented what happened to him. And I'll just show you a couple of pictures of what Fellini did after his right parietal stroke. So what you see here is his attempt to draw this very complex visual figure called the Ray Osterith. And, you know, if you have right hemisphere disease, it's very hard to put the gestalt together. And one of the things that happens is if you have a stroke on the right parietal lobe, you tend to neglect the left side of your world. So you lose the ability to copy, and also simultaneously, you know, you're having a lot of trouble putting things together in three dimensions. Even a great artist like Fellini, after a right parietal stroke, you know, produces these pieces. You see most of the action in these things is on the right side. And, you know, he was not going to just sit there and do a traditional neuropsychological copy, not Fellini. So he's placed these figures on top of the Ray Osterith. And notice all of the action, again, is on the right side because the injury to the right side of his brain forces him to neglect the salience of everything in the left part of his visual field. And here's another example of some of the things that he did in the setting of this stroke. And I think from emotional perspective, this is one of the most remarkable cartoons I've ever seen. So what you see here is his doctor, a female doctor. I don't think he liked her very much. I don't know. I just get that impression. He's recovering from that stroke, and he's regaining some of his ability to capture the world visually. And there she's explaining to Fellini, who's in this neglected left visual field, explaining to Fellini, you know, how he should be doing better in the ward and this sort of thing. So anyways, I think it's pretty intimidating for physicians to, you know, see how smart he saw this rehabilitation process with. So that's right parietal. You cannot copy precisely. You just can't do it if you've had that brain area injured. And I think what Betty Edwards is doing, and I think what happens in an art class when you try to learn how to draw realistically, is that you're pruning, increasing the potency of that right parietal lobe and the circuits that it's associated with. I think, great artists are, you know, just magnificently poised to put something on the canvas. Left brain injury, I'm going to show you some examples of patients that I've had who had degeneration of the language side of the brain, and you're going to see some of the art that they produced. It's a little different than, some of the things you saw from Fellini with lots of humor, lots of concept. You know, I think that was his left hemisphere drawing some of those pictures. And it was much more conceptual than these left brain injured patients that I'll talk about. The theme has been loss of the ability to make conceptual art and a relative sparing of what we call this visual constructive ability to look at something, copy it, or even more so what a great artist does is conjure up an image, probably disproportionately using that right parietal part of the brain and then putting that down onto a canvas. So here's one case history that I could find when I started studying this. And it's a story about a very famous European artist who was a conceptual artist. He made these huge pieces. And this is a piece that he called Exhumed. And what he's tried to do in this picture is visually represent the Holocaust. And each one of these little lines here represents the name of someone that died in a specific place. And so this is the kind of art that he did. I mean, clearly it used the right side of the brain as well, because these were massive, visually complicated pieces. But it had a very conceptual component to it. He had a small stroke on the left side of the brain, the language side. He continued to be able to copy beautifully, but what happened to this artist is he never produced a conceptual piece again. And so losing just a little bit of the left hemisphere that was involved with helping him to think up these major pieces really totally diminished his ability to produce conceptual art. So I'm going to show you some of my patients in a minute, and I think there's similarities between this story as well. So I study two major degenerative diseases, one that tends to affect the front part of the brain. So this is frontotemporal dementia. This is a real anatomic analysis of all of our patients with frontotemporal dementia, shown in blue compared to controls. All of our Alzheimer patients shown in red compared to controls. And the punchline here is that the frontotemporal dementias affect the front part of the brain, whereas Alzheimer's disease tends to hit the posterior part of the brain, including the right parietal lobe. So I think what we see very early on in many patients with Alzheimer's disease is this loss of ability to copy. And I think, I have seen in my practice many times, sadly, artists who have developed Alzheimer's disease who had a devastating loss of the ability to copy and produce the kind of art that they did. I'll show you exceptions to that rule in a few minutes. The story with frontotemporal dementia has been a little bit different. And one of the things we've learned is that when there is degeneration in the left frontal lobe or left anterior temporal lobes, sometimes we see individuals who develop a new visual preoccupation. And we've reported on a number of people, I'll show you some examples, who've actually produced amazing art, some of whom have never produced art before they started to get sick. So think of that dichotomy, front, back, and left and right. Okay, so this just shows you again the sort of deficits an Alzheimer patient has. And this is one of the first patients I ever looked after, a lovely nurse, 59 years of age. Not bad memory, just in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease. And you can see her language was a little bit better. She could spontaneously produce a sentence, almost get it right. But even the sentence, she's having trouble with the visual constructive component. She can't keep it together on the same line. And you ask her to draw those two intersecting pentagons, which we see almost every day in our clinics, and Alzheimer patients just can't do it. So that is a very typical deficit that an Alzheimer patient has. And again, much like Fellini, who had a stroke in the right parietal area, they don't have a stroke, but they have a degenerative process that really impedes this ability to visually translate complex visual information onto a canvas. So this is a painting from one of my Alzheimer patients, and I think it's not atypical, but I think it's very exemplary of the kind of work that Alzheimer patients produce. This was an artist. She produced much more complicated visual pieces before she developed her illness. But in the setting of Alzheimer's disease, she maintained, I think, this really wonderful sense of color, had lost the ability, I think, to draw faces, shapes. But I think she put together, in a very interesting way, the blue and the purple. And, I have to say it sits on my wall, and it's one of the things that I've looked at every day for almost 10 years with great pleasure. And so I think there's a lot of work with Alzheimer's disease patients, and, I think you have to have limited expectations about what they might do, but also appreciate the sort of things that their brain is still able to produce. And I think this is fairly typical of Alzheimer's disease. This is not so typical, and it's a gentleman who I've learned a lot about by working with his wife, an art historian named Patricia Untermullen. And so Untermullen was an artist who did a lot of portraits. He did a lot of social commentary art. Interesting, he was a little dyslexic, so I think very early on in his life, there was a little asymmetry with the left side not working quite as well. And his wife captured here a series of pictures that Untermullen did, first as an art student, a self-portrait, and then this series of portraits that he showed of himself as the Alzheimer's disease process went on. And I think it's a really courageous set of paintings. What it shows is Untermullen's willingness to show on a canvas how his artistic abilities in some ways are deteriorating, yet and show his own face as he saw it. And I think this really gives us insight into two things. One is the loss of his ability to show in a realistic way what his face looks like. But also I think it shows how he is seeing the outside world. And I think as his disease develops, he's having increasing trouble showing this realistic picture of his face. As you might have guessed, this Alzheimer's was associated with profound depression. He was just amazingly depressed throughout the course of his illness, and I think you see it. And, of course, some of you are thinking, as I do, my favorite piece is this last little one that he produced, fairly close to his death. One other thing I just want to say is that the picture in 1996, half of it was done before he realized he had Alzheimer's disease, and you know, he finished it after realizing he had Alzheimer's disease. So I find this you know, some of the most compelling paintings I've ever seen. He had Alzheimer's disease, I will say, having seen his MRI scans. It was more left-sided than many people, so I think his right side was a little bit preserved, and it allowed him, you know, to produce these pieces very late into the course of his illness, albeit changed. Okay, so I'm going to end by just, you know, saying a word or two about frontotemporal dementia. And, you know, I've written a lot about this, not because I thought I would see it, but just serendipitously. And, you know, because of the persistence of my patients and their caregivers who insisted that I take seriously this idea that some of them had actually developed increased visual creativity in the setting of their illness. And so the theme has been, patients with frontotemporal dementia can develop new artistic skills after disease onset. Visual creativity is more common when the anterior temporal lobes, I'll show you some examples of this, or left frontal lobe show focal degeneration. And a long time ago, I reported on 12 patients who showed the emergence of musical, much rarer, or visual ability in the setting of frontotemporal dementia. And so this is Mario Gorno-Tempini's description of the progressive aphasias, and these are individuals, and these are the ones where we see visual creativity, and it's anatomically no surprise. These are patients who have a degeneration either in the temporal lobe on the left, the parietal lobe, and that's what Untermullen had, an Alzheimer variant, and the frontal lobe shown in green. And these are individuals who sometimes in the setting of this degenerative disease, particularly patients where the temporal lobe is the nidus of the degeneration, where suddenly you see increased visual creativity. And I'll show you some examples. So these are individuals where there's degeneration of the temporal lobes, very focal, of course. And this is one of the lessons I've learned from these patients. None of these diseases hit the brain diffusely. They hit very focal parts of the brain. And our humanity is, you know, for the most part, preserved. And I think each of our patients, especially I've thought about in the setting of these artists, is really doing an Olympic effort of trying to, you know, present themselves as who they are and trying to, you know, cope with these devastating diseases. So parietal lobes are pretty spared in the semantic dementia. These individuals lose the meaning of words. They don't know what words mean. If you say, what is that? And they'd say, I don't know. And you'll say, well, it's a microphone. And they'll go, well, what's a microphone? I don't know what a microphone is. And so the left anterior temporal lobe seems to be really important for our ability to understand the meaning of objects in our world. When it's more right-sided, they lose meaning about faces. And I'll show you an example of that. Okay. So here's an example of what happens in these individuals. So this is a patient, and I've asked them to draw a dog, a cat, a fish, a bird. And this patient is really having a hard concept of what all those animals are. And they tend to make one prototypic animal that, you know, that has the features of something in evolution. So this is a picture of a patient where the fish looks a little bit like a turtle. The bird looks a little bit like a gnat, and so on. And this is the loss of knowledge about things in the world. So some of them become obsessed by drawing. And so this is a patient of mine who'd never painted before. It just came into my office and just decided that she had to draw me. She obviously didn't write the handsome because she would have misspelled it due to her aphasia, so someone else might have put that on. But again, this is the phenomenology. We see people who just suddenly become obsessed with painting. So here's my first patient, Jack, who started painting in the setting of his illness. I didn't believe that he was really getting better, but his son said, I want to show you 12 pictures. And indeed, over the course of this illness, he produced just amazing things. He couldn't have told you what a bird was when he painted this, but this is, I think, one of his masterpieces. This is a painting that I have, and it's a picture of a boat. And it's fovist, I think, and very beautiful use of color, and the sail is the sail. It's also the background. I think it makes you think maybe he's thinking in a slightly different, more original way about his visual world. I'll show you one experiment Indre did when she worked with me. Here's another patient. He was a mechanic. never painted, never the slightest interest in the setting of this temporal lobe degenerative disease. He took an art course and lost his job, but did a series of paintings that were quite beautiful. This is his childhood in New Mexico that he remembered. So the left side is involved with this conceptual knowledge, and the right side, the right anterior temporal lobe, seems to be very involved with understanding emotions in other people's faces. And so one of the things we've learned, if it's more right-sided temporal, people tend to become very unempathic because they don't understand what other people are feeling. We might have a caregiver who's crying sadly, and the patient looks at their mother and says, what's wrong? I'm feeling perfectly fine. And here's a study Howie Rosen did where he showed that the more severe the loss of tissue in the right amygdala, the more severe the deficit was in recognizing emotions on faces. And so here's an artist that developed frontotemporal dementia where the disease was more on the right anterior temporal lobe and the left. And he was obsessed with people. He could make no contact. He had a mail-order bride for 1 week. She left him. I mean, he was very isolated. Profound deficits in understanding emotions and faces, yet he just was obsessed with couples when he started to paint. He was a lawyer. He'd never painted before. And I think you capture his loneliness and how dissociated these couples are. And you can see the faces are distorted. They don't show one single emotion. They show a melange, a mixture of emotions that are happy, sad. And I think his deficit in understanding emotion is what makes these pictures so interesting. Again, couples together, but totally isolated. Couldn't be more separate. Here's as the disease progressed, he lost that ability to picture a face, and he starts, focusing on bicycles. And, the face is really beginning to disassemble. And then, very late into his illness, this is the last sort of work he did. And I think it used the very posterior part of the brain where he understood color and shape, but not much else. And so what happened in his brain was very much reflected on the canvas. And so this is the last thing I wanted to show, and this is an experiment that Indre did. And, Indre thought that these individuals thought about the world very differently. And so it's a very smart but simple paradigm. And she asks, what would you look at if you had semantic dementia and this temporal lobe disorder? Do you look at the world differently? And what you should be doing, and we did an experiment, and this little red dot is going to show you the eye movements, is you should be looking at the penguins. Well, look at what the semantic dementia patients do. So a very, very different strategy. And I think this is outside of the box strategy, and I think some of these individuals produced beautiful work because their brain was wired differently than the rest of us, and they were doing things in a very different way. So in conclusion, art uses both hemispheres. I think we really do have a double consciousness, a right-sided and a left-sided. Won't go into it too much, but maybe in questions. I think artistic ability may emerge in association with left hemisphere dysfunction. I think it's rewiring. It shows you the hope of these degenerative diseases. The brain isn't hit entirely, but some parts are actually rewiring. And I think it gives you insights into the degenerative process and insights also into our humanity. So thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you for that kind introduction, Dr. Miller. As Dr. Miller mentioned, I grew up in Tennessee, where I learned to play the guitar and to sing, but something was missing in my life, and that's why I moved to Boston. And when I moved to Boston, I became a Red Sox fan, and that's when they won the first of their two world championships. But I had to get out to the West because I'd never been out here, and I met Dr. Miller, and I just couldn't go anywhere else. And so when I came here, San Francisco all of a sudden became very successful in baseball, and now they've won two world championships. So I'm not planning to move anytime soon, but I may take bribes if you're a Dodger fan. Just kidding. So what I'd like to talk about today is how physician scientists such as myself and Dr. Miller work together with research scientists to try to come up with ways in a collaborative environment to tackle very complex problems in creative ways. We believe that it's only through interactions such as these that we can come up with very effective treatments for our patients. So I'm going to cover a lot of various topics today: mouse models, jellyfish, and stem cells. And they may seem a little bit diverse, but they center around a theme of creative tools that we use to try to tackle complex problems. So I'm going to start today with mouse models of Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, as you know, is a very important problem that we all face, and we're really behind on the treatment. We really need to come up with something soon. As you know, it's an impending epidemic. There are currently over 5 million Americans that suffer from the disease. It's expected by the year 2050, this number will increase to 13 million people. The costs to our economy are just dramatic. It's already $200 billion in cost today, and this number is expected to reach $1 trillion by the year 2050 if we do not come up with any effective treatments. If we had a treatment that would reduce the numbers in half, a treatment that would do that would just need to delay the symptoms by 5 years. So really, there is a lot of room here for any kind of effective therapies. Alzheimer's disease is now the sixth leading cause of death in the United States, and like I mentioned, an impending health crisis. As you can see, I'm showing here the autopsy brain of a patient with normal cognition, and also the autopsy of a patient that suffered from Alzheimer's disease. As you can see, it's a progressive neurodegenerative condition that affects many brain regions. Patients often present in the early stages with memory problems, and this is due to involvement of the medial temporal lobes, or the hippocampi, shown here. And you can see shrinkage of this region compared to a normal brain here on your left. As the disease progresses, patients will develop visual spatial problems, executive dysfunction, or difficulty with reasoning and judgment, and also language impairments. There's no question Alzheimer's is a very complicated disease. It involves numerous factors. And in the human brain, we have neurons that communicate with other neurons through these long processes called axons and their synaptic connections. And there are numerous factors that are inside and outside of these cells, and also in the support cells called microglia and in the blood vessels. And all of these are having a role in causing the disease. So what we do as scientists is we have to come up with simpler models to try to isolate key disease processes as they occur. And so one way we do this is to use model organisms. Now, model organisms need to have several essential criteria in order to be usable in research. And one of the essential criteria is that it needs to have a short lifespan. Now, we study mice because it meets a lot of these criteria. Mice have a lifespan of about 30 months, and because of that, we can study the disease process both in its early stages and in its later stages. Another advantage to mouse models is that the entire genome has been mapped, and for nearly every mouse gene, there's a related human gene that we can study. Another example of why mouse models are so helpful is that we can either remove or we can overexpress genes of interest. We can actually overexpress genes that are associated with disease, like the amyloid precursor protein. In this example, we've genetically engineered this mouse to express this amyloid precursor protein with mutations that are linked to Alzheimer's disease that make it more susceptible to be cut or cleaved into these toxic amyloid beta fragments. These mice can then be used for several functional measures, including cognition and behavior. We can look at the electrical activity of large neural networks. We can even look at the intracellular trafficking of different molecules. All of these things that would be difficult to do in larger organisms, we can do in mice. And also, many of the biological markers of disease, or biomarkers, that were initially seen in humans were later discovered and to be seen in the animal models. And surprisingly, some of the biomarkers that we first saw in the mouse models were later confirmed to occur in humans. And this is how we've discovered some of the newer biomarkers. clearly the mouse brain is not the same as the human brain. But despite the size differences, there are numerous biological processes that are conserved across species. The mouse never develops Alzheimer's disease spontaneously, but when we overexpress the human amyloid precursor protein with familial Alzheimer's disease mutations, the mouse brain has many of the same pathological features that we see in the human brain. These include amyloid beta plaques, shown here in red, and also distorted or dystrophic neurites, shown here in green, as you can see here. Now, one of the most powerful tests of learning and memory that we have for mouse models is the Morris water maze. This was designed by Richard Morris over 30 years ago. And this is a test of learning and memory where we place a mouse in this pool of water with opaque water and have it learn to find where a hidden platform is using visual cues that are placed around the room. The platform is hidden, but it's shown for you here. And above, you can see a schematic of the swim path of this mouse from an aerial view. So a normal mouse or non-transgenic mouse is able to find this hidden platform pretty easily, and it's gotten pretty good at finding it over a few trials. And so it pretty much knows where the platform is. Our Alzheimer's disease model, the APP mouse, has a lot more difficulty finding this platform. So he's swimming around, not really knowing where he's going. Many of us have probably experienced similar situations, looking for our car in the parking lot. So if he does not find the platform soon, we'll rescue him. We use this measure because we can quantify a lot of things. For instance, how much time he spends looking for the platform, how long it takes him to get to the platform. All these measures can be used to determine how severe the memory problems are and whether our treatments that we're using for memory are effective. As a neurologist who's now become a mouse specialist, I've just been amazed at all the different discoveries that have come out of this APP mouse. That was the one that I used was originally designed by Leonard Mookie, who's my laboratory mentor. From this J20 line that he designed, we have seen lots of cellular and molecular changes that we later confirmed in the human condition. We see seizures and even silent seizures that we now see also in the human condition. And I am hopeful that some of the treatments that we have for seizures in these mice will someday be effective or even soon be effective in our patients. Next, I'm going to switch gears a bit and talk about jellyfish. And you may be asking yourself what jellyfish have to do with neuroscience research or research at all. Well, in 2008, these three gentlemen won the Nobel Prize for their work on this jellyfish. Dr. Shimomura arrived from Nagoya University in 1961, and he arrived at the University of Washington. And where he was there was near Victoria, British Columbia, where this jellyfish lived. This is the Aquaria victoria jellyfish. And he was interested in studying bioluminescence proteins. What he did was isolate some proteins from the surrounding umbrella of this jellyfish. And there was one just conspicuously bright protein that was later called the green fluorescent protein. And this protein has really revolutionized science. Dr. Chaffee was then able to take this protein and express it in different organisms, including worms and bacteria, and his brilliantly green C. elegans worm graced the cover of Science magazine in 1994. Then Roger Chen, basically he is a pioneer in imaging research, and he took it to a whole new level. He found out ways to modify this protein so that it's brighter, and also came up with ways of making spectral variants so that it expresses blue or yellow, and also found ways to see biological processes as they occur in real time, such as genes expressing, turning on and off, looking at ion changes in the cell, intracellular trafficking. And as you can see, with the green fluorescent protein, we can see cells just in their intricate detail, unlike we could ever see before. Before this, we were really working in the dark and relying on old bench techniques that were our best guess as to what was going on. Now, I used the green fluorescent protein to transfect neurons in a dish. And when I do that, I transfect GFP, and this neuron will express it. And it can highlight its structure. And I can look at its structure and find the axon, which is this long process that the neuron, like I mentioned, uses to communicate with other neurons. When I identify the axon, within the axon I can label mitochondria. And these are really the energy factories of the cell. They are almost like the life source for the cell. Mitochondria I label in red with red fluorescent protein. And I have to tell you, when I first saw them under the microscope, it was just amazing to see them moving around like cars on the freeway. This video sped up a little bit, but it's really amazing to see how much they move. Now, I study Alzheimer's disease, and in Alzheimer's disease, there are traffic jams. And so I'm looking at ways that we can prevent these traffic jams from occurring. One other example that I wanted to show you is looking in the living mouse brain. Before recently, we were only able to look at movement of these organelles in a dish, and that's a bit of an artificial situation. In order to get closer to the human condition, we need to use models of higher complexity. And so what we're doing here is actually looking in the mouse brain, in a living brain, in a mouse that is anesthetized. And through a technique called transcranial two-photon microscopy, we can actually see the movement of these mitochondria. This is our first glimpse into the movements of mitochondria in the living brain. You can see them zipping by here and there. So this video is sped up a little bit, as you can see, but mitochondria in our brains are moving around all the time. It's really amazing to think about. Now, this is the closest that we are able to get to the human condition currently, but there is even one more advance that I wanted to tell you about that brings us even closer. This is human-derived stem cells. Stem cells get a lot of attention, so I wanted to start by giving a definition of exactly what a stem cell is. A stem cell is essentially any cell with the capacity to mature or differentiate into a specialized cell. This is how the human body is made. We all begin as a single cell, and through multiple divisions, the cells mature into more specialized tissues. And then eventually, a single cell can turn into a heart, bone, neurons, cartilage, everything. And you can imagine the therapeutic implications for using stem cells. We could use it for neurodegenerative disease, epilepsy, stroke, spinal cord injury, and not just in the brain, we can use it in other body regions as well. Due to lack of availability and also ethical considerations surrounding embryonic stem cells, we have to be creative about how to obtain these stem cells. And this is some technology that was pioneered by Shinya Yamanaka. Dr. Miller mentioned him just a minute ago. Dr. Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize just this year for his discovery of iPS cells. So one way to make stem cells is just to create them or engineer them. And this is exactly what we're doing here. The technique that he pioneered is taking skin cells from a patient and then growing them. They're called fibroblasts at this stage. Dr. Yamanaka discovered four genes that are able to basically turn back the clock on these cells. There were about 20 at the time, 24 or so at the time, and no one really knew exactly which factors would be important. What Dr. Yamanaka did was ingenious. He just threw them all in and then slowly just peeled back one at a time until he could find what were the four essential ones. This was thought to be pretty crazy at the time, but it worked. Now, he found these four factors that turn back the clock and turn these skin cells into stem cells. We can colonize and culture these stem cells so that they grow in colonies called induced pluripotent stem cells. And these pluripotent stem cells are pluripotent. Pluripotent means they can turn into anything. And so we can use these to derive neurons, heart tissue, bone, pretty much any part of any organ one would need. And there are many advantages to this. One advantage is that any tissue that would be transplanted into the patient from which it was derived would not be rejected as likely as tissue from another source would be. Another advantage is that we can We can study these cells, and we can study these cells in a dish, and we're studying a patient's own cells in an ex vivo situation, or outside of the body. And we can screen drugs or compounds that may improve the way the cells look. We can personalize the approach of our treatments for this patient. One example of iPS cells that we're using here at Gladstone is Yadong Wang's work on iPS-derived neurons from a patient with frontal temporal dementia, a disease Dr. Miller just mentioned that is a very common, devastating disorder for younger patients that develop dementia. This patient, his iPS-derived neurons do not look completely healthy. And Dr. Huang can actually correct this mutation, and the cells look pretty much normal again. Now he can actually add more mutations, and then the cells begin to degenerate and look unhealthy. So this is just the proof of principle that we can study a patient's cells in a dish. And it would be great if we could figure out ways to study compounds that will improve the health of these neurons. So what I've shown you today are just a few of the examples of how physician scientists and research scientists at UCSF, Gladstone, and throughout this community are working together to try to come up with solutions that will improve the lives of our patients. And I've shown you some real novel therapies, some novel techniques that we think will reach clinical usage soon. We're discovering ways to pre-screen treatments in animal models that will later be used in clinical trials. We're turning to more of a personalized medicine approach where we're taking cells from a patient and studying that disease in the dish and thinking of ways to treat disease that is both cell-specific and mutation-specific, just like we're doing in cancer research already. And you can only imagine the regenerative applications of these stem cells, like I mentioned. I have numerous people to thank. I, like I mentioned, came here as a fellow in neurology and neuroscience research under Dr. Muki and Dr. Miller. And I showed you some of the work of Dr. Yamanaka and Yadong Huang and some of these other people here. I have to mention, though, I'm really indebted to the research patients and their families because my own research involves studying people in the hospital for up to 2 days with EEG monitoring. I'm just amazed at how many people are willing to give up much of their time and put their own issues or their own concerns aside for the benefit of really society. I think that it's just amazing. And even with people that are working, it's just been really gratifying to work in this Bay Area where people are volunteering as much as they do. So I appreciate your time and your attention.
I do want to thank Dr. Miller for that very warm introduction. My time here at UCSF was certainly not one of the down moments of my career, but rather a stepping stone. I was very fortunate that when I was here, I was allowed, by Dr. Miller's generosity, to do a postdoc and also go across town and do a master's of music at the Conservatory of Music. I think there's very few people in the world that would allow someone to do that, and he did that. I'm very grateful for that. And now I'm on faculty at the Conservatory of Music, and I'm the first neuroscientist who's been hired at a music conservatory to teach music students how to use their brains to develop effective practice strategies. So it's a cross-pollination. But I'm going to do this joint presentation with Heidi Clare, but I'm going to first start off with telling you a little bit of the science behind what makes a performer effective as a musician. And then she'll talk a little bit more from the musician's perspective. But first, let me start off by saying music is all around us, and there are many different ways in which we can listen to music. Sometimes we use it to pump us up when we need to work out, or to help us grieve over a loss. Or sometimes it's a very intellectual endeavor. And although, as there are many different types of music, there are many different ways of listening to music. But what I'm most interested in as a musician is active listening, people who are focusing in on my performance and are moved by it in some way. One of the wonderful things about this active listening is that sometimes you have the sublime experience of getting chills. Literally, you get goosebumps caused by the music. And this, from the musician's perspective, is really gratifying. But from the scientific perspective, it's really wonderful because we can measure it. And that's not true about a lot of other qualities of music where it's very subjective and we can't measure it. So I'll talk a little bit today about what happens when you get the chills and what parts of the brain are involved, seemingly, in inducing that wonderful feeling. What accounts for this variability in musical preference? A lot of people have talked for a lot of centuries about this and trying to find that sweet spot of getting just the right music that will appeal to their audiences. It turns out that your prior experience with music influences what music you like in the future, and that there is this inverted U-shaped curve to do with complexity as related to your preference. So there is a sweet spot at the top of the curve where the music is just complex enough where you still find it interesting and compelling, but it's not so complex that you can't understand it or anticipate what's going to happen next. When we're little children, we like very simple melodies, and as any parent knows, it's amazing how often the child could listen to the same song over and over and over again. But for us, it's not that interesting anymore. We want to have something that has a more, slightly more unanticipated structure. But it's this ability to anticipate what comes next and then be surprised by it, even though it fits in the same structure, that allows us to really enjoy music in that visceral way. So this understanding the structure of music is something that is very important for musicians so that we can figure out how to set up your expectations and then draw out that expectations, create the tension that eventually you know will be released, and it turns out that that's what's enjoyable. That in the cases in which you do get these goosebumps, it's this combination of the anticipation, this tension, this drawn-out experience, and then finally the release that gives you the reward that music is able to do. So one of the composers of whom I'm most fond is Mozart, and he learned to do this very effectively. And here's just an example. It's an aria from The Magic Flute that Pamina sings, and in it he uses a musical feature called the appoggiatura, or a leaning in which one note leads to the next note. And a lot of musicians use this in a lot of different genres. But in this particular aria, this leaning in extends the sort of the pathetic quality of it, that she's actually sobbing. So if you look at the first part of the aria, it's a very simple sort of a just going down a very simple chord. So if he didn't write in this leaning in, it would sound something like this. Ach, ich fühl's. Very simple, pretty boring, not very emotional. But instead, she's sobbing. So instead of writing it like that, what he writes is, ach, ich fühl's. So you actually see that the physical nature of the sobbing, and you feel that tension and release that happens when you know what's coming, but at the same time, that it's not quite there yet, and you have to go through the tension to get there. I'm belaboring this point a little bit because it turns out that this is exactly the kind of thing that gives us the chills. And often, it's not the up-tempo music or the loud cacophony that is what gives us goosebumps, but rather a solo instrument coming out of a cacophony of sound. And some psychologists have gone so far as to speculate that it's because this type of musical scenario mimics the distress call of a child, and we are evolutionarily primed to respond to it in this autonomic way. I don't know if that's true, but it's a very nice story. And certainly, there are a lot of examples in all types of genre of music in which this happens. So there's the guitar solo, or the soprano line, or the violin crying that gives us the chills. So as I mentioned before, the chills are wonderful because they give us these very measurable responses where we can actually measure something physical about someone. We don't need to rely on our unreliable subjects to tell us what they're feeling. We can actually measure it. And what's nice for neuroimaging work is that what gives one person the chills doesn't give another person the chills. And so we can use the different musical phrases from one person to another as a control. So when we put our patients or our healthy controls in the scanner, we can use the same stimuli, and the only thing that's different between the different situations is whether or not the person in the scanner is getting the chills. So for this particular subject, it was It was Rachmaninoff that was giving him the chills, but Barber left him flat. And in the other subject, it was the opposite. And so we can compare what's happening in the brains of these two subjects, even though they're listening to the same same pieces of music. So not surprisingly, the chills correlate with activity in the reward circuitry of the brain. So the same part of your brain that is active when you're doing anything rewarding, whether it's eating or having sex or taking drugs, is also active when you're listening to music and you get the chills. What's interesting is that in this particular study, these were experienced listeners or musicians themselves who were being studied. And when they were getting the chills, they actually saw a decrease in activity in some regions of the brain, the medial temporal lobe, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, that are involved in remembering episodes in their lives. And in fact, they said that the musical excerpts that they listened to did not produce associations with things that have happened to them in their lives. This might be because they've had so many different experiences that, you know, no single piece of music is associated with one particular experience. But I would argue that it's maybe more likely that they're actually not thinking about what's going on in their lives. And these parts of the brain are part of the sort of default resting state of our mind that is always active when we're thinking about what we need to do next, our grocery list, or taxes, etc. And when you can get the chills from a piece of music, you can turn off that part of your brain and not have to focus on all those daily things that come in, but rather get immersed in the experience. Getting in the zone is what some people call us, and as musicians, that's really what we want. So a follow-up study just last year was published in which the neuroscientists actually superimposed fMRI or brain activity during the anticipation and then the experience of a pleasure in music with what's happening chemically in the brain. So not only can we see what parts of the brain are active, as we saw in the previous study, but we can actually measure how much dopamine, how much of the neurotransmitter that was involved in that system is also present during this experience. And I mention this because one of the most interesting findings of this work is that you see this dissociation between what's happening during the anticipation phase of the music and the experience. And as musicians, we work very hard to elongate that anticipation phase. We want to keep you in that phase so that by the time we release the tension, it's just that much more pleasurable. That's our intuitive sense, and this is one of the first studies that actually backs it up. And shows that, yes, during this entire anticipatory phase, there's a part of your brain that is more active, and then once you actually get the release of tension, it's less interested. Whereas that's not the case with the nucleus accumbens. The nucleus accumbens is the part of your brain that is associated with those very psychostimulant and the sort of peak of pleasure. And it's highly interconnected with other emotional parts of the brain. Whereas the caudate, which is this part of the brain that is involved in this anticipatory phase, is much more tied to your sensory and other association areas, and it's the part of your brain that lays down associations between rewarding things and the reward itself. So you learn when you're experiencing a particular piece of music, and over time there's this part of your brain that's saying, hey, you know what, you should pay attention to this because it's going to lead to this. And now we see that there's actually this physical signature in the brain, which is not surprising to a neuroscientist, but when I tell other musicians, they're shocked. So the question is it just the piece of music itself, or does the performance matter? And of course, this is something that I'm very interested in, because I don't want the world to just be a series of tape performances or computers making the music that I'm so interested in making myself. So I just want to briefly show you a video of a neuroimaging study in which they had a pianist play on a digital keyboard a very expressive Chopin etude. And then they took that digital signature and they got rid of two things. They made it the same tempo all the way through, and they got rid of the dynamic changes. And that's it. And the question is, are those two things important for an effective performance? And the answer, of course, is yes. But before I say that too emphatically, I'll let you listen to what they call mechanical performance so that you can judge for yourself. Okay, that's enough of that. But the point of that video was that you would see this tempo fluctuation, that part of the brain, when there's an expressive performance, follows the tempo. And then you can see this build-up of anticipation. You can see the build-up in the brain of these different parts of the brain that are active. And as you come to the peak of the performance, you see the brain responds in a similar way. And the different parts of the brain that are involved in this experience to the music are part of what's known as the human mirror neuron system. So this is a whole series of different areas in the brain that are involved in when you're watching someone else do an activity. There's a part of your brain that, if you're interested in it, that is also mimicking what it would be like if you were doing that activity yourself. This is the system in the brain that seems to be affected in people with autism. And it's also the same system in the brain that seems to underlie empathy, our capacity to imagine the intentions and the minds of another person. And so I would argue that what's happening when especially experienced musicians are listening to someone else playing the type of music that they're most interested in, that they are mimicking in a way. Their brains are feeling this empathy, are activating in such a way as if they were the ones who are doing the performance themselves. So on that note, I'm going to hand it off to Heidi.
I don't have a computer. gosh, there's not a lot of time, but I just want to touch on a few things. I'm a teacher as well as a performer, and for me, successful teaching, to have a successful lesson with a student, I have to make sure that I deliver new material with familiar. And you see this all across the board with music. Bob Dylan's one of my favorite examples because he will use sort of American cliches, going down Roan feeling bad, you know, lines like that. And then that brings you in because you know that line. And then he'll, you know, bring in his own personal poetry. And he gets in trouble for that. And every time somebody says, brings that up to me, I always say, it's brilliant. He's bringing us in so that we can accept whatever he is trying to say. And anyway, I think that's it's something that is really important in teaching, but it's also important just in delivering new music. How many of you been to maybe the symphony or some kind of performance where it's new music and you feel like, wow, my brain is working so hard and I'm still not getting it? It's hard, and I think it's so important for the composers and the performers to really figure out how to bring us in, how to pull us in. As a performer, that's my job, is to pull my audience in. And one of the things that's really important to me is brain engagement. And I have been doing this for many, many years, but never actually thought about it. And with Dr. Miller bringing me in, I've had to look at it in different ways. And it's true, as Indre said, when we are engaged musically, we're not thinking of what happened in the past or what's happening around the corner. And that's the only way I can make good music. And so I thought I'd just give you an example of this, because this is something that you can take if you go to see a live show, which I hope you do often, that it is the way it's why you're moved. And if that musician's brain is not properly engaged in the music, you won't be moved. And so here's a tune. This is an American tune, and it really goes back a lot of years and a lot of different genres as well. But I'm an old-time fiddler or bluegrass, either one, whichever your preference. And I'll play you this tune. This is called Turkey in the Straw. I'm going to play it first just disengaged. I'll probably think about what I might be having for dinner. Or about my early early flight tomorrow morning. And I'm hoping I actually make it to BART on time. But I'm not going to be thinking about music. I'm going to do my best to completely disengage, but I'm going to play it very accurately, as if I was reading it from a page. Thank you. So now I'm going to play it fully engaged. So that I will just, for me, it's literally like turning on a light switch. And I've developed this over a bunch of years because there was a period of time when I was playing in a band that was very difficult for me, and I lost this ability and had to relearn it. And so I actually have a system, but it literally is like turning on a light switch, and if it goes back off, I just turn it right back on. That's fun. Thanks for listening. So I just want to talk about one other thing. This is just something that happened this last weekend. It was interesting to deal with, and then we're going to head over that way. And Andrea and I will play a little music, so come join us. But this last weekend, I play old time, as I mentioned, or bluegrass, and this last weekend I played in I guess you'd say sort of an alt country / rock and roll band with Bill Kirchen, amazing guitar player. Love his music. We had a drummer, full on drummer, did not hold back. My ears are still ringing. But they sent me some songs to learn, and so I learned them, learned all the breaks, and learned all the different keys, and I was just having a great time. So Friday night we played at the Throckmorton in Mill Valley, and it was really fun. It was great. I felt like we did a great job. We entertained the audience. So we had two more gigs the next two nights, and they were having such a great time. They started throwing all this new music at me. And I could not engage my brain the way I wanted to because I was having to think about the key, the progression, the, trying to do as little painful sounds as possible. And it was really hard. After Friday night, I was so elated and I felt so good. I can't explain it, but when you've had a great gig, you just have this completion, this feeling of really positive completion. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday were okay, but I left the evening going, oh, gosh, all those notes. Wish I could have been so engaged, properly engaged. But with that, I think we'll. Did you need to close, or do we just head over there?
I could close just by
thanking
Heidi,
Andre. So Heidi tells me her gigs are done for a little bit. Indre's going to be playing with her choral group on November 18th, and you can
string quartet.
A string quartet. Keith is going to be up here working in the laboratory for the rest of the month, and we're going to help you get over. And you're going to hear this incredibly eclectic mix of Indre in opera and Heidi in bluegrass. So wow, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.